Wow, I love that theme music.
What? It's very fitting.
Yeah, and it's very appropriate today because our theme today is our Oscar special, our 2024, looking back on 2023 Oscar special.
Was that John Williams? or yeah, knockoff AI version of John Williams?
No, he just got another nomination because of that track I just played.
Indiana Jones. So,
I'm telling you, Joe has connections. I've been saying this for a year and a half.
I'm like, John, whip up a little something for our podcast, and that's what he came up with. So yeah, yesterday, the day before we record this podcast, the Academy announced their Oscar nominations for 20. Now this gets a little confusing because when you go back and you look or you try to do some research and you go, what were the 2023 Oscar winners? There's some confusion because sometimes it refers to 2023 as being the year that had passed, but then they might call it the 2024 Oscars because that's when they're taking place. And it can get really confusing as you go back and look at past winners and stuff. But
if you follow sports, the Super Bowl takes place in the year after the season starts.
Exactly. Same thing. So basically we're going to
one more game till Vegas.
60 minutes. So we're going to kind of look at most of the Oscar nominations that were announced. We don't have to do all of them. And then we're going to kind of look back at the history of the Oscars, upsets and some of your favorite picks and controversial moments and things like that. You know, I always say I watch the Oscars every year, not only because I'm a movie buff, but it's like waiting for a train wreck to happen. You're like, what is going to go wrong this year? And that rarely disappoints. Usually something happens where you're like, holy cow.
See, Joe, you're that guy when you know there's ice on the highway, you stand off the side like, wait for the speed to hit.
That's
we're
right.
We're going to get a 50-car pileup.
I pull out my – I'm the guy recording the semi sliding on the freeway and going, oh, this is going to be good. So, yeah, we'll get into some of those controversial moments in a little bit. But let's talk about the top story of this year's announcements that Godzilla got nominated for an award. Nick, I know you're happy. Imagine those, Pete. I know you're happy about that. First time ever a Godzilla movie has been nominated for an Academy Award.
Look, three things. Yes, I am happy. This also feels like people congratulating the Detroit Lions. Hey, you guys finally won a playoff game. I'm like, there's a feeling like a little bit of backhand in this. And I'd also like to welcome our guest who has joined us. Because everyone's wondering, like, who the hell? Someone just walked in, like, no. Andrew has brought a wonderful guest on.
Yes, my longtime friend, Robert Butler. We grew up on the same street when we were in our single digits.
Wow.
And then haven't seen each other in over probably 30 years, right?
Wow.
Something like that. He found me on Facebook a couple months ago, and we've just been messaging each other, reminding each other of, like, hey, do you remember when we were 6, 7, 8 years old and watching the first season of the X-Men animated series in your parents' living room and jumping off the couch? He was always Wolverine. I was always Gambit. My sister Alexa was always Rogue.
That's awesome.
He was one of he was the first person I played the original Nintendo with.
Wow. Well, so, welcome, Robert. Thanks for joining us. You call yourself a movie buff. Are you a fan of movies?
For sure, yeah. I'm actually a film reviewer as well. I
have great.
A website called De Facto Film Reviews, so I actually get to see a lot of the movies early.
Oh, nice.
He gets screeners.
He gets screeners.
That's awesome.
Yeah, get to 10 screenings. I go to some of the festivals. I went to New York Film Festival in October, and I've actually seen all 10 of the Best Picture nominees.
Wow.
Yeah, every night he's watching a different film.
So, That's great. We got some clout here.
So, and also You have a feature film. What's it called? Blood Simple.
I wish it was Blood Simple.
No.
Bloody Mortal.
Bloody Mortal. I was close.
This was first and goal on the 1 yard line, man. First and goal on the 1 yard line.
But anyway, it is on Amazon and is on some of the free ones. Voodoo TV.
Yep.
I watched it on TV.
Cool.
It was shot all here in Michigan, downtown Detroit. It's a movie about some vampires.
Cool. And, fantastic.
And he's a couple short films that I haven't watched yet, but I'm going to. So, and he's currently in production. Can we talk a little bit about your current film just for a moment?
Well, I want to say thank you for having me here today. I appreciate it. But yes, I have a new film that I'm working on right now called Phantom Moon. We're halfway shot with that movie, and we plan on finishing hopefully this year.
So. Awesome.
And nice. And you're trying hard to get who in the movie?
Well, we do actually have Danny Trejo signed on the movie.
Danny Trejo.
Yes. Machete.
Machete's in the movie.
The machete's in the movie, yeah, but exactly. Trying to get the resources together, and our goal is to shoot it this spring or summer, the rest of it. So
that's fantastic.
So not only do you have an awesome radio voice, you also are more knowledgeable. Why do we keep setting the floor on these things? For God's sakes.
He may end up replacing one of you guys. Yeah.
The writing is on the wall.
Now, you guys better not slip up today. So, we'll see. I mentioned Godzilla. That was fun. But there's a bigger story to come out of this, and it's just amazing the way this plays out. The Barbie movie is a movie that kind of addresses the patriarchy versus, you know, women being in charge, men being in charge, whether you're in the Barbie world or the real world. And it kind of makes this statement that speaks to a lot of women today. And it was an enormous box office success. And when I saw it in the theater, I liked it. I didn't love it. But I have family members, mostly women. As a matter of fact, when I saw the movie, I think I was the only guy in the theater. But I know women who wept, who like cried when they saw this movie. And it really spoke to women, and they really embraced this movie and made it a box office success. So imagine the irony when the Oscar nominations are announced, that Barbie gets a Best Picture nomination. America Ferrara got nominated for Supporting Actress. And then Ryan Gosling gets nominated for Best Supporting Actor.
Right.
The director, Greta Gerwig, did not get nominated. And the star of the movie, Margot Robbie, who I thought did a fantastic job in the movie, did not get nominated. So now that's causing this backlash, and people are being very vocal about it on the internet. Now, there's some factors that have led to this happening. And part of the reason is the fact that the Academy nominates 10 Best Pictures, but only 5 directors, which means 5 directors are not getting a nomination.
Right.
And so I heard someone bring this up. Maybe it was on social media. Someone said, all right, if you think Greta Gerwig deserved that directing nomination, who do you take off that list? And everyone looks at each other like, oh, I don't know. So that's part of the problem. It feels like they should go back to the system that they had briefly, where if a nominee got a certain percentage of the votes, then they were a nominee. And maybe they should do that beyond the movie categories, even though now they're at 10 again. And just sort of a backstory on that. Used to be 5 Best Pictures. Then it went up to 10 in response to the Dark Knight fiasco that happened.
Yeah. 2008.
And then after a few years of that, they said, well, we don't want to force ourselves to come up with 10. So then they came up with this mathematical system where if it received a certain percentage of the votes, it would become a nominee, but it could be anywhere from 5 to 10. And they did that for a number of years. Now they're back to forcing themselves to have 10 nominations. Should the other categories reflect that? It doesn't seem right that there should be 10 movie Best Picture nominations, but the other categories don't follow suit. And it feels almost like the 10 Best Picture nominations is almost kind of like pandering to the audience, because the reason they did that is the Academy is notorious for snubbing popular films.
Yeah.
The movies that people love rarely get recognition from the Academy. So they were like, we'll throw you a bone and we'll do 10 movies. But by adding 5 movies, that did not increase the likelihood that popular movies were going to get recognized. It was just a way, I think, to draw more viewers in, saying, you know, Titanic got nominated or something, you know, just to, you know, draw people in. But they don't traditionally recognize popular movies. So without, you know, if they didn't force themselves to fill up this 10 movie Best Picture nomination list, would Barbie have even made the cut? Would it have been one of the top 5 movies of the year? I don't know.
I don't think it would have.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
What do you think?
If you were to shave this down to 5, I don't think Barbie would have made it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. And it's kind of a shame, because, you know, it's definitely the biggest movie of the year, and it made so much money. But unfortunately, there's there's a disconnect between movies that make money and are popular and movies that are nominated for Best Picture. And the Academy and the Oscars always seem to be kind of elitist. Like, if we look at this Best Picture list, there are a couple of titles on here where I'm like, I've never heard of this, and I didn't know it existed until I saw the list. Right. I've never heard of The Zone of Interest. I don't know what that is. It might be a great movie. You saw it, Robert, right?
I did, yeah.
I've never heard of it prior to seeing the list when it was announced. I've tried to see some of these movies. Some seem really interesting, even though I hope they put some of these titles on streaming soon to give people a chance to get caught up.
Yes.
But like, I read a little description about American Fiction, and it sounds very intriguing. I tend to like uplifting, fun movies, and it sounds like American Fiction is sort of a fun ride. Yeah.
Holdovers, too.
Thank you.
Yeah. And so.
I love it.
Oh, great
I love
movie.
Holdovers.
That's going to be my next one.
All right. I watched it last night. We'll talk about that in a second.
Nice.
So, yeah, you know, a lot of these movies are sort of, you know, down and depressing, and it's very rare that they celebrate an uplifting, fun movie. It happens occasionally, but rarely. But here's a list of Best Picture. American Fiction, which I haven't seen. Anatomy of a Fall, which I have not seen. Barbie, I saw in theaters. The Holdovers, I watched on Peacock last night. Killers of the Flower Moon, I have not seen yet, only because I need to set aside 4 hours to sit down and watch this movie. Maestro, I've heard mixed reviews about. I have not seen it. Oppenheimer, I saw just fairly recently because I knew that Andrew was going to want to talk about it on our last podcast. Past Lives, I'm not familiar with. Poor Things, I watched the trailer for Poor Things because a friend of mine reached out to me and said, hey, you want to go see Poor Things? And I looked at the trailer and I said, no thanks. It looks freaking bizarre.
It is.
And then The Zone of Interest, I've never heard of. So let's go around the table. Nick, of these 10 nominees, what have you seen? What jumps out at you?
On this list, I've seen 4. I've seen American Fiction, seen The Holdovers, I've seen Oppenheimer, and I've seen Barbie. I have yet to see the others. I do intend to, because Poor Things is Netflix. That's Netflix's, you know, trying to get, like, we can make Oscar movies.
Poor Things on Netflix? Yeah.
No, Poor Things is actually
Searchlight.
Searchlight film in the theaters right now.
Yeah, is Netflix distributing it, or?
Not at the moment.
No. Not at the moment? Oh, okay.
They'll probably go on Hulu eventually.
Oh, okay, fair enough. Okay. I was, for some reason, I thought Poor Things was going to be on Netflix, but no, for me, and of all those 4 movies, I thought American Fiction and Holdovers were fantastic. Barbie, I watched it, and the problem was I saw it after all the hype.
Right.
So it doesn't live up to the hype, and that's like the cardinal sin. Don't listen to the hype before you go see it.
I try to see movies as quickly as possible so I don't fall into that trap.
Yep, same here.
Yeah.
Oppenheimer, because I'm just a fan. So I'm rooting for American Fiction, Holdovers in almost every category. I thought Sterling K. Brown was fantastic in American Fiction. I love him. I love Jeffrey Wright. Mm-hmm. And I got a soft spot for Paul Giamatti. I always will.
Yeah, think he's one of our finest actors today.
Yep.
Andrew, let me ask you this. Do you think any of these movies have a prayer against Oppenheimer? I feel like Oppenheimer has all the buzz. It has the momentum. It's winning awards in other award ceremonies.
I
have a hard time believing that there's a movie on this list that's going to upset Oppenheimer.
I think out of the 13 noms it has, I think it's going to win 7 or 8 of them, and I think Best Picture is one of them.
Yeah.
I think they have it in the bag. Definitely not Killers, definitely not Barbie. There might be a dark horse in Holdovers or American Fiction.
You know what I'm scared of? Poor Things. I feel like that's like that horse on the Kentucky Derby. it comes around the corner.
It might be one of those weird upsets. I don't see that happening.
That horse has 3 legs.
Yeah.
It's catching up.
I'm just waiting for that. I'm going, you know, everyone's like, oh, it's going to be Oppenheimer. And the Best Picture goes to, dramatic pause, Poor Things. And it's going to be like, throw your card in the air. Like, what?
Yeah, that's going to screw up everyone's bingo cards. Robert, you've seen all of these. Which one is most likely going to upset Oppenheimer?
At this time, I don't think anything, but if I were to say if anything were to do it, I would probably say Barbie. It could be another.
Wow. That's really shocking.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen, but if anything would, it would be that, because you have to look at this Coda, Everything Everywhere All at Once, Parasite, a lot of populism behind those movies. If one movie was to do it, I would say Barbie. It's got a huge online clout, you know, X, Twitter before the followers really brought a lot of momentum to those previous Best Picture winners. But I do think at the moment, Oppenheimer is the clear front runner.
I'm liking Robert's dark horse. I love the reasoning behind the dark horse as well. So he, because he's like, you would not think it is, but populism, just keep an eye on it. I'm like, yep.
Now, I dug up this little tidbit because of the Barbie scandal. The Academy Award for Best Picture and Best Director have been closely linked throughout their history. Of the 95 films at the time of this writing that have won Best Picture, 68 have also been awarded Best Director. So 68 of the 95 films that won Best Picture also won Best Director.
That's roughly two-thirds. I wouldn't have thought it was that high.
Now, only six films have been awarded Best Picture without getting a Best Director nomination. Wings, which was the very first movie to win Best Picture, the director did not get a nomination. Grand Hotel, which is an epic, epic film, did not get a director nomination. Here's a shocking one. Driving Miss Daisy.
Oh.
Best Picture winner didn't even get a director nomination. Shocking. Argo. Directed by Ben Affleck. Argo won Best Picture. Ben Affleck was not recognized. Green Book won Best Picture. Was not Peter Farrelly did not get a nomination. Coda won Best Picture. Was not did not get the director nomination. Only two Best Director winners to win for films that did not receive a Best Picture nomination, which is odd. I didn't even know that was a thing. Were during the early years of the awards. Lewis Milestone won in 1927/28 for Two Arabian Nights, and Frank Lloyd for The Divine Lady, 28-29. So imagine getting a Best Director award, but your film doesn't even get a Best Picture nomination.
That could be Maestro then. It's with Bradley Cooper. If Maestro pulls off, comes, you know, Best Picture, but he never got a Best Director.
He got
a best actor, not so he was able to direct himself to a Best Actor and Best Picture, but he's not a Best Director.
So it has happened, and again, I think because of the 10 picture thing that kind of set this up for the fall, people are outraged.
Let me ask you, Joe, is it harder to get a 100% accurate Oscar bracket compared to a March Madness bracket?
I used to have an Oscar party where I would have a lot of people come over and fill out ballots and stuff, but it got a little controversial because I don't know where people were going to get their information, but there were a couple of people who were coming to my Oscar party every year and getting like 99% correct. And I'm like, where are you getting your information from? Because I kind of pick mine based on my gut feeling, but there were people who were like, I would see them on their phones looking something up, and they would fill out their ballot and then get like all but one correct. And I'm like, okay, something's up.
What was the name of the company that's responsible for the security of the?
The briefcase.
Yeah.
It'll pop into my head.
They do tax audits and stuff.
Your buddy like calling them.
Yeah, somehow they got an insight on that. So,
but I got to say that Robert, he predicted all 10 of the best pictures on Facebook before they were announced.
Ooh, interesting.
He was batting 1,000. All 10 of them.
And I don't even go on that website, Gold Derby. I just, from following like the guilds and the critic groups and stuff like that, I just had a feeling you could start to know the momentum.
Yeah.
Goes further.
You know what? All of a sudden, I'm looking at Barbie. Now, if that's the case, I'm looking at Barbie.
It's still Oppenheimer, I think, is going to win. But if one thing would be it, I'm telling you, Barbie would be the
Because he's got a point now, because you were mentioned controversy. So, you know, Maestro would have a negative controversy because people are like, oh, why is Bradley Cooper playing that character? Should he be the best one?
Yeah.
And so that's a negative controversy. But, you know, Barbie not getting, you know, with the Greta Gerwig controversy. Now, if the Academy reacts, if they're susceptible, oh, we can't have this. You know what? We'll show them.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, I'm going to be like, looking at Robert, like, Robert called it.
See, that's
the
problem.
It's very possible.
It's a problem I have with the Oscars is they're not, don't freak out here, but they're not always based on merit. And no. I know that may shock you.
How dare you?
I hate the fact that when it comes time to come up with the nominations, if an actor finds himself in a scandal, even though he had a brilliant performance on the screen, he is left off the list of nominations. And that always bugs me, that what an actor might do privately will affect the results of Oscar nominations. I'm going to throw out an example, and maybe you guys might not agree with me here, but what was the James Franco movie that was based on The Room? What was that called?
Disaster Artist.
Disaster Artist. Yeah. When I saw Disaster Artist in the theater, I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I thought James Franco was brilliant in it. Then he got caught up in this scandal right around the time that Oscar nominations were coming in, and he was completely left off the list of nominees. And that scandal, in my opinion, had everything to do with it. Now, should that affect the nominations? And this goes back to a podcast that we did a year or so ago about the artist versus the art. Yeah. Should you let an artist's actions off screen impact his body of work? You look at people like Kevin Spacey. Do you think Kevin Spacey will ever get an Oscar nomination, even though he's one of our generation's most brilliant, brilliant actors of
all
time?
Now, let me ask you that. Let's say all the controversy with Kevin Spacey comes out, but instead it comes out at the time and L.A. Confidential comes out.
Right.
Or Usual Suspect comes out. You know, well, you know, he did all that stuff, but look at those movies.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't deny it.
He was brilliant in those movies.
Yeah, American Beauty.
So, yeah. Now, excellent movie. The scandal with Kevin Spacey happened after all those movies. But so, yeah, you're right. If he were to do an L.A. Confidential today, and then a scandal broke right around the time of the nominations and he was left off,
that would be an outrage.
Yeah. That would be an outrage. Yeah. So, yeah, it kind of bugs me that other factors come into play when crafting these nominations.
I'm glad you mentioned that. Andrew and Rob, I want to get your opinion on this, because I read that right here, during 1998, Shakespeare in Love beat Saving Private Ryan for Best Picture. And the rumor was that Harvey Weinstein was actively and aggressively campaigning for Shakespeare in Love behind the scenes, going so far as to do negative comments, like almost doing like a character assassination of the movie and all that kind of stuff. And I went, well, now you can kind of believe it. Like, yeah, that kind of fits the profile, knowing what we know about Harvey Weinstein. But that's how Shakespeare in Love, because Harrison Ford was giving the nomination. That was meant to be, you know, you want to have a moment, Indiana Jones giving to Steven Spielberg for Saving Private Ryan, which was Weinstein. Apparently one of the comments that he said was that movie's only good for the first 15 minutes. That's all it is. So the back 2 hours of nothing. And I went, and then Shakespeare in Love won.
I've never heard that.
Yeah, for sure. It happened, Andrew, around that time. Saving Private Ryan was the front runner. If you watched the movie, you'd be like, oh, it's going to win.
Yeah.
Up until maybe like 2 weeks before, he started hearing, he'd be upset. And
As early as 2 weeks before?
Two weeks before. Oh, like, Entertainment Tonight was saying Shakespeare in Love could possibly dethrone it. And then, sure enough, it happened.
So that's the Weinstein effect.
Yeah. Him and his team, they were feeding BS to the media.
Well, I'm going to jump in here. I have this habit. A lot of Oscar nominated movies I don't see until they announce the nominations. Then I try to make an effort to go see them if they're still playing in theaters. And the year of this Shakespeare in Love controversy, I assumed, Saving Private Ryan is the front runner. There's no way it's going to lose. Then I saw Shakespeare in Love. Have you guys seen Shakespeare in Love?
Yes.
I love it. I love the
freaking
movie.
Great.
No.
It is awesome.
I honestly haven't heard anything about it. I mean, I know it exists. And,
Gwyneth Paltrow.
Gwyneth and
Joseph
Fiennes. Even Ben Affleck was great in it.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't even
supporting
know he was
role.
In it.
Yeah.
Now.
This happens often, Robert.
Yeah.
These guys have seen more movies than I have, so...
Yeah. Now, had Shakespeare in Love come out any other year, I don't think anyone would question its win. But because it upset Saving Private Ryan, now people go, Shakespeare in Love. It's freaking great. And if you haven't seen it, see it. It's fantastic.
I will extend an olive branch, even though, because I still think Shakespeare in Love should not have won that, because I will go to my grave with Saving Private Ryan. That is similar. We were talking about this before the show started. 1995, Shawshank Redemption, and Forrest Gump. You know, Forrest Gump won. People are like, well, Shawshank, and I love both movies.
Yeah, I think Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, that too. And it beat Pulp Fiction. So
what a year.
Oh, yeah,
oh my God, what a year.
Wow.
So one of the greatest years for movies ever.
Someone's going to lose.
Yeah.
Someone's got to lose. So yeah. I would just put it in there like, hey, you know, Shakespeare, love, you know.
Sometimes it does a movie better. It does better for the legacy of a movie if it doesn't win. Look at Goodfellas.
Yeah.
I mean, Goodfellas lost to Dances with Wolves, but,
yeah,
you know, Goodfellas has a strong reputation. A lot of people look back at that, or like Raging Bull, not winning, losing to Ordinary People. We talk about Raging Bull more, even like Pulp Fiction is a great example.
We now have the benefit of hindsight, and you can go back, and I printed up a list of all the best picture winners, and you can go back and look at some of those titles that have won Oscars, and you go, wait, I don't remember anything about that movie. Like, there are movies that certain best picture winners defeated that have stood the test of time, that are still talked about to this day. So, but we have the benefit of hindsight, you know, time, with the passage of time, which movies continue to stay in the public eye and which ones fade away.
Absolutely.
And I can't explain why these things happen. Like, Robert, you probably can correct me here, or maybe give me some insight, but I don't know what Coda is. I've never seen it. I don't know anything about it.
Yes.
It was an Apple's movie.
2 years ago, it was the best picture winner.
It was a good movie.
But are people talking about it? No. What's your opinion of Coda?
I think it's a charming film. It's a well-intended movie. You know, it does a lot of great inclusive stuff with the deaf community, actually casting.
Yep.
Deaf characters in the movie and whatnot. But you're right, though. But that movie was, you know, released after the pandemic, just afterwards during it, and played on Apple TV, which not everybody has Apple. But there was a big, you know, following for that movie at the time on Twitter that existed. And look, my favorite movie that year was nominated for picture and director. That was Licorice Pizza by Paul Thomas Anderson, the director of Boogie Nights. But but to your point, though, I see a lot of more people talking about Licorice Pizza more than that particular movie now.
Yeah.
Yep. And we were talking about this, 1942. How Green Was My Valley?
And John Ford movie. What movie did it beat?
Citizen Kane. Yeah. Citizen Kane. I'm like, what?
So crazy. So
the
crazy.
Number one movie of all time.
Yeah. Every time a greatest movie list is published, Citizen Kane is either at the top or near the top. And it lost Best Picture to How Green Was My Valley, which is one of the few Oscar-winning movies I've never seen yet. I should add that to my
Last year for its 80th anniversary.
Yeah.
It's a great movie, but still Citizen Kane, I feel, is the stronger film.
Sure. Yeah, that's one thing that's interesting when you go back and watch some of these accolades, these movie with accolades and Oscars and all this stuff. Sometimes I'll go back and watch a classic and go, okay, yeah, I see it. And sometimes I watch a classic and go, what the hell? Like, I don't understand how this got nominated, let alone
a winner. This is the uncultured savage in me. That's 2021 Nomadland. I had no idea because that's the height of the pandemic. You know, 2022, you're emerging from it. You could say, okay, let's start paying a little bit of attention. I'm like, Nomad. When you said, I'm like, well, what is this? What is this strange movie here?
That was with Frances McDormand.
Frances McDormand, yeah, she won her third Oscar for that movie. I do recommend that Nomadland.
But I heard it was good. I don't know much about it. And like I said, it's another one of those. Is anyone talking about it?
Right.
It's a hard movie to recommend during the pandemic. Nobody wanted to watch a movie that dealt with some distressing themes at the time.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so. And I think that continues to this day. I have friends who are like, I'm kind of done with the downer movies, the disturbing movies. I know you guys kind of like those, but I don't want to do that to myself. Yeah, I don't like the I don't want to walk out of a movie theater feeling bad. Like I go to the movies to escape the harsh realities that we have to deal with on a daily basis.
So what you're saying is, had Schindler's List come out during the pandemic, 2021, it may not have gotten its thing. I mean,
I made out through most of Schindler's List, so I don't remember much of it. But now that's a Seinfeld reference. But
yeah, I was about to say.
Now that's another thing. You know, this since you brought up Schindler's List, one thing about one criteria I look for a movie that stands the test of time is repeated viewings.
Yeah. Yes.
Now, my favorite movies, and I challenge you guys to come up with your 100 favorite movie list. Most of the movies on my list are movies if it's raining and it's on TV, I'm watching it. Mm. And I've seen some movies like Star Wars, Back to the Future, Indiana Jones, dozens, if not 100 times.
Yeah, yeah.
And those are the movies that end up on my favorite movie list. Now, some of the greatest movies ever made deservedly are called the greatest movie ever made. But how many times are you going to sit down and watch Schindler's List on a rainy Sunday afternoon? I'm going to hang myself by the end. It's like, no, those are hard to watch over and over and over again. Do they deserve the title of greatest movie ever made? Yes. Is it my favorite movie ever made? No, because I watched it and never wanted to see it again. Like, it's too depressing. So I have separate lists. I have the greatest movies ever made list and my favorite movies ever made list. And there's a little bit of, the Venn diagram.
Oh, yeah.
But for the most part, take Saving Private Ryan. I remember I've seen Saving Private Ryan maybe three times or whatever. And the last time I saw it, we had family visiting from Spain. We were sitting at my sister's house, and a cousin of mine was like, do you have Saving Private Ryan? And we're like, yeah. We popped it in and watched it. That is not a movie that you sit there with family watching. Like, that was, I was like looking away, like feeling awkward. Like, I don't like this feeling. So,
all right, everybody, we have the Avengers and Saving Private Ryan. Who wants one?
Who wants to watch a guy's guts get spilled out on
the popcorn munch?
On the shores of Normandy.
So is it a great movie? Yes. But it's a tough watch. It's hard to watch that movie multiple times. Now, you guys might be different. You might go, hey, let's pop in some Saving Private Ryan, but I'm just not wired that way.
I got to be in the mood to watch that type of, like, visceral violence. I mean, don't get me wrong. You know me. I love my horror movies, but I don't like necessarily excessive gore. I can do without it. I like the psychological. I like a little bit of a slow burn. Nick, I got a question for you. Do you think, if you were to guess yes or no, if I've ever seen Schindler's List, what would you think?
No. My default answer is no.
I have never seen Schindler's List.
That is my default answer. After doing this with you for almost 2 years, my default answer is you have not seen it.
I have not seen it, and I'm ashamed about that because I love Spielberg, and I know that's one of the biggest movies of the 90s, but I gotta find a streaming. Look at Joe's just sitting there.
You could ask me. I would give you even odds if you've seen The Sun.
I haven't seen it in about 3 months. But
that's right.
Ever.
I'm gonna have to create a disclaimer at the beginning of the podcast. The views and opinions of the host of this podcast may not have seen the movies we're talking about. That's shocking to me.
No, but I do like what you mentioned about on this list. Again, I love that Andrew and Joe did homework and brought stuff, and I've contributed nothing. But when you talk about blockbuster movies, you know, I look at this list, Rob, you know, I see Titanic. Like, oh, look, on just this list alone, if I take just from 1998, include 1998, Titanic, Lord of the Rings are probably the big blockbuster. They got the nominations and they backed up the box office.
Exactly.
Yep.
But everything else is, you know, you could say it made some money, but they're truly for dramatic appeal. That's why when the Oscars were saying, "Oh, how come you're not including the big, you know, Batman popcorn?" Yeah, look, I don't want to give Michael Bay an Oscar for Transformers just because it's $1 billion. No, I'm not putting it on the list.
Right. Yeah.
Sometimes there's an overlap, like a Venn diagram. You'll get the box office and the art.
Right.
Yes.
Balance.
One movie that comes to mind is Gladiator. Monster hit. One of the greatest movies ever made. And so it was nice when all of that came together to get the accolades, the awards, and the box office. I love when all of that comes together.
Mm-hmm. Although that's the one movie, it's on my favorite list. There's the part with the wife and son. I'll skip. I'm like, I've seen it. Let's get to the action part because I don't want to relive it. Because that's but the first time I ever saw that, I almost bawled. I was like, oh, God, I feel for this guy. Damn, Maximus. He's in the whole kissing his wife's crucified feet. I'm like, all right. And I get that. Joaquin Phoenix, you were a good actor.
Yeah.
I've never seen Gladiator either.
Oh, I'm
No, that feels like a troll. That
are
feels
you serious?
No,
are you mocking us? I'm about ready to leap over this table,
this
man.
This is why you have not spoken to him in 30 years. This all makes perfect sense now.
I don't see how you could be 18 years old and 2000 and not see Gladiator.
I know.
I saw
American. I snuck in as a 15-year-old and saw American Beauty.
You just
AMC.
Wanted to see.
You know what's the saddest thing? This is why we can't have a drinking game. We'd be dead sober if we had to take a shot every time Andrew had seen one of these movies. We'd be dead sober. This thing goes back to 1928.
You know what? I get mad at myself when I finally get around to seeing a movie that people have told me to watch for years. And when I sit down and love it, I get mad at myself that I've spent a portion of my life not having been exposed to this movie. Like, yeah, I eventually get to it.
Sure.
But an old classic that I just watched recently was Miss Miniver was one of them. And is that the one? That's the wartime one. Miss Miniver was the wartime UK production or something. But then there's another one with... I should have wrote these down. Joan Crawford. What was the big one that she had? Mildred Pierce.
Mildred Pierce.
I'm embarrassed to say this. I'd never seen Mildred Pierce until just a few months ago. And I think I found it at Second and Charles used DVD. I popped it in. I watched it. I'm like, Joe, you're a disgrace. You host these movie podcasts and you're only just now seeing this movie.
It was that good.
It was that good. And you go, okay, I get the whole Joan Crawford thing now.
Is that like, in like probably mid-50s? Or
30s, Great Depression. Yeah.
So, I get mad at myself when I try to make an effort to see these nominated movies, but just some of them don't appeal to me. But
that's because you don't utilize the Drew shield like I do. Because I always say, as long as I have Drew next to me, I won't have to feel as bad. I won't feel that type of guilt. I'm like, God, Nick, how did you not see? Like, I felt the
Thanks.
Same. No, look. We have to use it. Otherwise, it's a waste of not seeing movies. We have to have some benefit to it. You know, Joe brought up a good point because I felt that way about The French Connection for a while. Because I always enjoy these movies.
Yes.
And
like, great movie.
Yes. And I didn't
that,
see that.
That chase scene. Oh, my God.
You know what? You know when the first time I saw that? In the 21st century.
Oh, yeah.
And that was like about 2004. I was like, oh, friend, you know, I've been talking about it. Gene Hackman.
I saw it before you. I saw it in high school, probably 2002.
Ooh, look at
that.
This is a
first.
This is
he
a first.
Gets a credit. Yeah.
But 2004, I saw French Connection. What took me so long?
You know what changed my life? I don't know if this is literally, but what changed my life? I was on Facebook the other day, and you know how you get the memories come up? And I was looking at my memories, and it was the 15th anniversary of me joining Netflix. But
it was when
you got DVDs in the mail.
I used to
long before the streaming. I think streaming might have been a separate option. But I signed up to the DVD subscription thing, and I got to the point where I can have two DVDs at any given moment. And
wow, so, high class.
So 15 years ago is when I created a wish list of about 100 movies, and I said, I'm going to knock out this list. And I saw all the classics in a relatively short period of time. And that's when I got caught up on a lot of these great
movies.
So you
gave them the foundational data for binge watching. Like some dude ordered 16 DVDs and he returned them all and he must have seen them all in a row.
Yeah.
That's binge watching.
When I had... when they allowed me to watch two, what would happen is one would come in the mail, I'd watch it, seal it up, mail it back. The second one would come in, I'd watch it, seal it up, mail it back. And so I was getting pretty much on average two movies a week, and I was turning them around quickly. They did not collect dust.
When I lived in Houston for 2.5 years, I did that, but through Blockbuster used to have a thing. And I would find things like, I did the opposite. I would look for the most obscure, you know, sci-fi horror, maybe a Woody Allen movie that, you know, you can't find on DVD or you can't find anywhere else, you know. And that's when I watched a lot of indie films when I was in Houston. And I had the same thing. Every other day I was getting them in the mail. Yep.
And I feel like I'm a better person for having finally got caught up. Yeah. I went through a Hitchcock phase where I was getting one Hitchcock movie after another. And I felt like they were empowering me, like, I'm eating a mushroom in Mario, like, and I'm like,
and then getting a star.
Oh, my God. Imagine within the last 15 years, seeing North by Northwest for the first time. Like, I got to see movies like that for the first time, and I'm like, these are freaking great. So I came out of that. I emerged from that a better person having seen those
movies. You talk about someone, and Robert, you could probably, you talk about someone who's the Buffalo Bills of, he had the, what, 58, 59, 60, North by Northwest, Vertigo, Psycho.
Yeah.
Didn't get a nominee. Right. Like, nothing. He just, it, I was like, what? 3 years ago, like, Hitchcock should win this, right? This year?
Yeah.
This year? Like, you got to be kidding me.
His 1940s and 50s filmography on that stage is just unfathomable to think that he made all those great movies.
Yeah. Did he ever win an
Oscar? I don't think he did.
Oscar? No. For anything, like, director or?
And you talk about personality.
Oh, wow. So
maybe that his personality, his the rumors of him in Hollywood might have come back to bite him in the ass.
You know, who else had that Susan Lucci curse for a long time? Was Steven Spielberg. I mean, when you think about the treasures that he contributed to cinema, he was not recognized for a long, long time until Schindler's List.
Yeah, and about a good 20 years since he entered Hollywood.
And it was
minimum
shocking. Like, what did Hollywood have against Spielberg?
E.T.
Isn't that with Scorsese, too? Scorsese.
Yeah, well, interesting fact, just with this nomination that Scorsese got, he just surpassed Spielberg at 10 nominations. Spielberg had 9 Best Director nominees. Scorsese has 10, and now William Wyler has the record of 12. It's like Joe DiMaggio in baseball. I
mean,
can Scorsese surpass him? He's in, you know, he's like 80 now. I mean, anything's possible. And he can make 3 more movies.
But he's got one to his name.
Yeah.
He's got one
Oscar.
For
The Departed.
Yeah, for The Departed in 2006. His first nominee, was Raging Bull?
Yes.
Yeah, so they're talking about 25 years.
Best Director nominee. Was
Best Director,
Well, you know, talking about great movies that didn't get a director nomination, you mentioned Jaws. If I were to say that Jaws did not get a Best Director nomination, it's incredulous. Like, are you kidding me? Jaws is one of the greatest movies of all time, and it did not. He did not get, and he was this young upstart, and they almost pulled the plug on that movie.
That movie aged him.
Yeah, and to think he did not get a director nomination for that is one of the great travesties of the history of the Oscars.
And Taxi Driver, Scorsese did not get director nomination.
Yeah,
for that.
Gosh,
the picture nominee, but not director.
God,
you know, you talk about a 10% win percentage on that thing. That's like John Williams. John Williams has what, 94 nominations and 5 Oscar wins. Wow. At some point, I'm like, you got to. I'm like, no.
Imagine being a composer and they're like, hey, you got nominated for an Oscar, and you're like, who else got nominated? John Williams. Damn it. Like, you know you're not.
That's where
going
I take the nomination as the win. I'm like, I made the final 4. I'm good. Everything else is gravy. But then, and then you're sitting there going, and the winner is John Williams. Other guy. What? I'm almost mad I won. Could you imagine you beat John Williams? And like,
oh, my God. I would be using that line at the bar all the time. Little known fact. So, and let's talk about these Best Picture nominees. Yeah. Of the ones that I have seen, all of them are flawed. None of them are perfect. Andrew, I know you love Oppenheimer. And when I watched it, I liked it. I didn't love it. But not only did I think an hour could have been trimmed out of that film, but there were some questionable decisions made by Christopher Nolan. We talked about it on our last podcast, but like the sex scene in during the hearing, like,
The hallucination.
Why was that necessary? And the decision to focus on that trial, basically the hearing, and not necessarily on the aftermath of killing tens of thousands of people with this bomb you created.
Sure.
There were some questionable decisions made. So, yeah, it's the front runner, and it's a great movie, but it's definitely flawed. Let's talk about The Holdovers. You said you love The Holdovers.
No, I haven't. I haven't seen it.
You saw The Holdovers?
Yeah,
I
love it. These two loved it.
I watched it last night, and the only reason it took so long for me to watch it is because looking at the trailers and stuff, I'm like, we've seen this before. We've seen Dead Poets Society. We've seen, what was the Matt Damon, Ben Affleck movie? Good Will Hunting. We've seen these mentor professors and you know, troublesome students. And we've seen it time and time again. And that's one of the problems that I have with the film is it didn't feel very fresh or original to me. It was something that we had seen many, many times. I thought it was a little pretentious, the dialogue. Like, there were times where I'm like, I don't know what they're saying here. It was like, I almost had to turn on subtitles to figure out what was being said here. Like, when Paul Giamatti's character was kind of beating down the guys in the bar, and he says something to him, and they turn to the student, like, what did he just say?
The Dodo Bird
he wants
quote.
To buy you a drink. But he used, like, this flowery language to get it across. And to me, it felt a little pretentious, a little wordy, a little slow. And like I said, I've seen that premise before. So I don't think it's necessarily a front runner. What can you say to defend the Holdovers?
I'm going to defer to Robert on this, because all that I'm going to say is Paul Giamatti. And it's a sad, sad defense. I'm like, Paul Giamatti. Everything, it's like, I'm going to plead the fifth. I'm going to plead the Paul Giamatti.
That's like going to Rotten Tomatoes and go, what's this movie about? Description, Paul Giamatti. Oh, that sounds good.
And that's why I can't be an honest film critic. I defer to people like Robert, who actually have talent in this.
Robert, let's do point, counterpoint. I just made my point about the Holdovers. Can you counterpoint it?
Well, Joe, everything that you brought up has been long-standing criticisms of Alexander Payne, the director of this film. He didn't write the screenplay, but he got a writer in the film that went to boarding school. But, you know, this dates back to Election, About Schmidt, Sideways. His films, in a way, are kind of an acquired taste, but I do think that they're accessible enough to meet general appeal. And his films are very sophisticated. Some could dismiss it as pretentious. Sure. You know, a lot of films are about intellectuals, and they kind of have that snooty side. But what I love about Payne movies is he brings, no pun intended here, pain to his characters, and they're very flawed characters. They're very lonely characters, and he really taps into the human condition quite well, especially with Paul Giamatti's character here. He's a very sad, lonely guy. He kind of masks himself as this grandiose, smart professor, but deep down, he's a very
isolated,
lonely man. Yeah, and he ends up finding a strong connection with this young boy in the film, and he ends up seeing there's a lot of reflections of himself within him. It's almost like a younger version of himself.
And I'm going to dumb down the point here by saying I got a little bit of Rick and Morty taste in it. There's a little bit of Rick and Morty. Just a tad bit. I was like the mentor, and this is like the whiny student, and he's like, what is wrong with you, man?
I love the character depth in the movie, though. I like the performances. And
It almost felt too real. Like, I felt like I was hanging out on campus with these guys, which is a testament to the movie, but not a great story. Like, hanging out with someone in the middle of winter on a campus is kind of boring. And that's kind of what I got from the movie. But, and also, I don't want to ruin the ending or anything, but I, you know, my Hollywood thing that I enjoy in movies is when the good guy gets rewarded or redeemed and the villain, you know, gets punished or whatever. And the ending of the movie, I thought, Paul Giamatti's character didn't deserve the ending that he got in the movie. And so as the credits are rolling, I was like depressed. Like,
really?
Oh, he didn't deserve that.
I was kind of rooting for him because he's going to have a new beginning, a new chapter in his life. Because I think at the end of the day, he needed, not revealing anything, but I think he needed a new start.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, that encounter with the kid and the troubles they went through is going to launch a new beginning for him. So that's kind of how I
maybe it just kind of set off a panic in me, because I'm closing in on 60, and if I was told by my boss, hey, start a new chapter, I'd be like, oh shit, man. And that's kind of how I felt at the end of the movie. Like, you know, he's an older guy, and he's starting over at this point. So
it takes a little bit of that up in the air moment when they're telling J.K. Simmons, when George Clooney tells him, you get a chance to, what'd you want to do? What dream did? How much they pay you to give up on your dream?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I want to be a cook. And he says, well, go do that now. Cook for your family. Like, so maybe that's why I took a little bit of that with Paul Giamatti, when, like Robert was saying at the end.
Yeah, he runs into his old classmate. He kind of disguised. He pretty much spills the beans what he wants to be, teaching at Harvard and stuff like that. So kind of what I got out of it, he's going to go into something better.
Hopefully. Yeah, that's what I hope. That's what I guess what
it's
I choose
up to interpret. Yeah.
That's what I choose to believe.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the beauty of art. Let me interpret how I feel Paul Giamatti's character would have gone and done that. Did you like how I chat GPT'd everything of Robert? I let him put all the work, and I'm like, I'm just going to chat GPT all this.
You gave him the parameters, and he filled in the blanks.
And that's how you do it, kids. That's how you do. Don't contribute anything.
Now, one thing I found mildly distracting in the film is early on in the film, I'm like, I did not know Paul Giamatti had a lazy eye. And it turns out that was some sort of an effect or
yes.
a lens or something. But it was a creative decision that the director made. And I think he collaborated with Giamatti, and they decided together that he should have a lazy eye. The weird thing that I found distracting is that it changed eyes. Sometimes it was his left eye. Sometimes it was right eye.
Kind of like the humps on
Yeah.
Oh,
he did it?
I have to wait for that next time.
I did not notice
they
that.
They said it was a deliberate call, like they wanted
holy
to
shit,
that do
is young
that.
Frankenstein
because there's this moment in the movie where Paul Giamatti says it's this eye, and I'm like, well, 10 minutes ago it was the other eye, god damn it. But it was a deliberate call that they made.
Wow.
And so I find gimmicks like that a little distracting. Now I'm like looking for his lazy eye.
Now,
and I shouldn't be looking for that.
I'm not gonna go to theater to go see it again, but when it comes out, I'm going to freeze frame just to find that out now.
Yeah.
Jeez.
It's it. Now showing on Peacock.
I love that performance, though. I love the actress who plays Mary Lamb, too. The Boyne Joy Rudolph.
I think you know what she's from? I was sitting there watching the movie going, where do I know her from? Did you recognize her? Do you know what she's from?
I saw her in a movie called Kajillionaire 3 years ago. I know she's been in other things, but that's what I recognized her from.
When I finally made the connection, I don't know if you guys have seen it, but she is the police detective in Only Murders in the Building.
Yes.
And when I made that connection, I'm like, oh, that's where I know
I
her
see
from.
That, but
and yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. I didn't think initially her character was given a whole lot to do, but then they reached a point in the film where I'm like, holy shit, she's acting her ass off. So, yeah, she was fantastic.
And my dark horse to win the Best Supporting Actor.
Now, the young actor, the student in it, apparently that was his first film role. Yep. And nice. Was it Giamatti that campaigned for him, I think?
Payne ran into
he did?
Him.
He campaigned for him. And- okay.
That's his first ever acting
that
gig?
That was his first gig,
Wow.
So,
what am I doing? Isn't that also true with Lily Gladstone?
No, she's in stuff before, but this is like her first big studio movie.
Studio movie. Okay.
Yeah. Did like a lot of indies and stuff.
Oh, okay.
It's like Fogel and Superbad.
So when it comes to Best Picture, is the general consensus here going to be Oppenheimer? Is Oppenheimer going to get it?
I agree with Robert. It is going to be Oppenheimer, but then I want Robert to be right. I want his dark horse pick to happen.
And I'm of the idea like I want Oppenheimer to win. I think it should win, but I'm not going to be pissed if something else wins. It's like the voters in Hollywood they decide what it is, and you know that's what it is. And there have been like dark coming out of left field wins in the past, and it's like, all right, that's just how it goes.
I'm not saying anything, but I'm just going to ask a question here to all three of you. Do people know who the voters are, who the members of the Academy are?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So is it possible
the members of the Academy? I mean, I'm sure there's a list out there somewhere, but that's why, a few years ago they expanded membership to include more diversity and minorities and stuff because, there was that Oscar so white controversy that happened years ago. And then I found out, because I remember when someone was griping that like all the acting nominations were white, and I'm like, well, isn't there people of color on the Academy that's nominated? And I found out that like 95% or so of the Academy was white. And I was like, what the hell? It was shocking. Yep. So they expanded membership and invited more diversity. And you're seeing the result in the nominations.
I'm going to put a mental note for this. That'd be a topic for a future episode, because after the Oscars, how do they pick the Academy members? How do you get on that list? Because that's almost like a Congress member. You'd be lobbying so hard. People are like, hey, let's go to that Michelin star restaurant. Hey, by the way, fancy meeting you here.
I would imagine it's not unlike joining a union. I think if you pony up the dough and apply for membership and you meet certain criteria, then you could become an Academy member. So.
Because I figured that list would be safely guarded. Because otherwise, who wouldn't spend the money to try and influence? Just like you say, there's 100 members. I need to get 20 to have a shot.
Well, that's not allowed, is it? Are people allowed to campaign directly? I mean, there are. You do send. Producers can send out these. Screeners, as they call them. I mean, I don't know if they can even do that anymore, but they used to send out screeners to make sure that all the members saw these films that might have had a limited release in theater. So here's a copy you can watch in the comfort of your own home. So I don't know if that's still allowed to actively campaign like that.
Well, they still have screeners, but there's certain rules where you can't do like a grassroots campaign. Like last year, Till Leslie ran into some controversies because they were renting out theaters, trying to invite, you know, last minute industry people to see it. It's all about, you know, watching the movies and stuff like that. That's what it all comes down to.
Yeah.
You know, Barbie, of course, everybody saw Barbie. It was well liked by the, you know, public and by the industry. A lot of people in the infrastructure like it as well. So that's why it was nominated. So it all depends who's watching the movies and if they watched them.
Yeah. And you know, that's always kind of controversial too, is, you know, a movie has to be seen in a theater by the end of the calendar year. So a lot of these nominated films get this very limited release in New York and LA in like on December 20th or something.
Right.
And that's why a lot of people like us in the Midwest are like, what the hell is this?
Right.
Because they showed them just to beat the deadline in these major cities.
That's how the streamers, like that dilapidated building I just turned into a theater. That's Amazon's theater. That's Netflix's theater. That's Apple's theater.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons why I think it's Netflix bought the Egyptian on Hollywood Boulevard and just recently renovated it, because they wanted to have their films qualify for the Academy Award. So they're going to show them at the theater
for 2 weeks.
Right. Yeah, to get consideration.
You have to play in New York and L.A. for a certain amount of time, and you got to open before December 25th or whatever it is.
Yeah.
A certain date.
Yeah. So that's why there's kind of this disconnect between Hollywood and the regular average moviegoers. It's like, what is this? Because it was only shown in two cities.
Like the Zone of Interest, for instance, that's finally opening here this weekend at
the
Maple
Theater. That's a UK movie, right?
Yep. Yeah. And it played in New York last month.
It's only playing at the Maple?
Only at the Maple.
Wow.
I mean, it'll probably expand how depending on all it does there. And if it gets an audience, it'll expand to wider theaters.
But it drives me crazy when I hear about a movie I want to see, and then you try to find it, and it's like, oh, you just missed it. It was at the Maple for 24 hours. I'm like, what? It's very frustrating. And I remember, not that this deviates from our Oscar talk, but there's the movie Black Dynamite. You remember Black Dynamite?
Yeah.
People were raving about this movie. Yeah. I couldn't find it anywhere. It wasn't showing anywhere.
Only the Burton Theater played that down in Detroit. One of them.
Yeah.
Independent theater.
Yeah. And so when it came out on DVD, I remember the Tuesday it came out on DVD, I ran to Target. I found it. I bought it sight unseen, took it home, popped it in, and laughed my ass off. Yeah. And it's one of my all-time favorite comedies. Why did it not get a wide mainstream release? I will never understand that. So now it's considered a cult favorite.
Now, Robert, let me ask you something. When do films that do well on the film festival circuit, does that help them with their Oscar? Like, is it like almost like building a campaign? Like,
yeah, absolutely. Like, the films that start off at Sundance or Toronto or Cannes or New York Film Festival, the big ones, that's where the buzz happens. That's where the publications go, the big critics, the audiences get to participate, and that's where the buzz starts flowing.
Yeah. So you're talking about like Variety, Hollywood Reporter, and all
yes.
that kind of stuff. Yep. Okay.
That's sort of like your interview audition of, hey, I'm putting this out here. Do you guys like this?
Yeah.
Early.
Does it have legs?
Yeah.
So, now, I forget which festival this was, but one of the tidbits I looked up about the holdovers is that it was submitted to some film festival somewhere. Nobody knew what the hell this thing was. I don't even think it was like invited. I think it just sort of did a guerrilla campaign and was shown at this thing. And got a $30 million buyout at this festival.
Wow. That was Telluride or Toronto.
Was it
played at both those places?
Okay.
Both of them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so they're buyers in the audience for these.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah. That's where, like, so, you know, Miramax would buy.
Yeah. So it's like baseball scouts checking out the minor leagues.
Yeah.
It's
a market.
See what's going on.
So if you have an idea for a film and your goal is the Oscars,
if you can get it into a festival,
you basically say, okay, my calendar, I'm trying to get to the 2026 Oscars, so I know in 2025 I have to start off at this film festival.
Exactly. Yep.
And then go to here and here. And you can't go to all of them, so do you cherry pick the big ones? Do you like Sundance, Tribeca?
Exactly. Yeah. If you're like a first-time filmmaker, you got stronger chances of going to Sundance probably, which is still very difficult to get into, mind you. But if you're a filmmaker that's a little bit more prolific, like Alexander Payne, the holdovers, he was able to get into Toronto. Focus bought it out at one of those festivals. It was Miramax on the European rights.
Yeah, that's what was kind of interesting about the holdovers is the opening credits. I'm like, am I watching the right movie? Because you heard like popping and cracking on the soundtrack, and you saw like hairs and dust on the screen, and then like the Miramax logo came up, and I'm like, what am I watching? Is this the right movie? And it just did this deliberate 70s kind of a feel of like you're watching an old movie. And I thought, okay, you got me. Yeah, you hooked me with that. That was pretty
old
cool.
Old Hal Ashby film.
Yeah.
Harold and Maude.
Yeah. So, yeah, if it gets buzz at the festivals, then they try to carry that into the Oscars, trying to get that theater screening, because that's a mandate, you know. It has to be shown in a theater to get Oscar consideration.
And so if you rack up enough buzz on the film festivals, some theater in L.A. or New York will play it.
Yeah.
That's your goal.
Well, the distributor will do it.
Oh, right, right. Okay.
And they'll try to get it by December, you know.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the other categories here. Again, you know, I look at this list. The next one that's on here is Best Actress. I look at this list. I haven't heard of some of these movies. I don't. What is it? Naiad? Is that how you pronounce that? I've never heard of that. Yeah. I don't know that is.
But the lady who did the swimming from Cuba to Florida. She tried for 40 years. Annette Bening plays the role.
Oh, okay.
Naiad.
Any standouts to you? Who do you think is going to come away with that?
This is going to be a very close race between Lily Gladstone from Killers of the Flower Moon being the first Native American to win. She's great in this. Or Emma Stone for Poor Things. It's going to come down to that. So keep an outlook at that SAG. Whoever wins the SAG will probably walk away with the Oscars. It's going to be a very tough race. It's going to come down to one of those two ladies. If I had to take a pick right now, I'm going to say Gladstone because Stone has won it before.
Here we go. That's all. That's. I hate to say it. This is almost like I'm mining Robert for, like, I'm going to win Oscar bingo. I'm like, oh, okay, so he said Gladstone, right, but I'll put a little dot next to
Stone could win, too.
This has nothing to do with merit again, but when I watched the trailer for Poor Things, the Oscars have a tendency to reward actresses who are beautiful but are in a role that really tones that down. And when I saw Emma Stone in the trailer for Poor Things, I was like, yikes.
Yeah.
You know?
You're thinking Charlize Theron and Monster.
Exactly. Oh,
transformation.
Exactly. Yeah. And so just looking at her transformation alone, I'm like, boy, there's got to be people looking at this going, holy cow, she's really going all out in this role. So, you know, we'll see. I mean, that has nothing to do with her performance. That's just kind of a conspiracy theory I have. Best Actor, Bradley Cooper, Maestro, Colman Domingo, Rustin. I've never heard of that. Paul Giamatti, always great in Holdovers. Jeffrey Wright, who I absolutely love in American Fiction. And apparently that's going to start streaming in a week or so. So I can't wait to sit down and watch that. And then Cillian Murphy, Oppenheimer.
And I'm violating my Paul Giamatti rule. Do you think this would be me? This is Paul Giamatti the way. I love Jeffrey Wright. I'm taking Jeffrey Wright on this.
Really?
Until Robert tells me to change it.
I'm going to tell you to change it because none of these actors have a chance to unseat Cillian Murphy. His performance, whether you love the movie or not, you can't deny that it was an amazing performance.
Okay.
And
so
the
way my brain,
the
heart.
Camera just like showcased every crease and crevice of his face, and he showed concern and stress and just not even saying anything, just looking at his face. I don't think I have a doubt in my mind that Cillian Murphy's going to win Best Actor. Robert, would you agree with that?
I think it's going to be a two-man race. I think it's going to come down to Giamatti for Holdovers or Murphy, Cillian Murphy for Oppenheimer. I think you saw the split clearly at the Golden Globes. Comedy went to Giamatti. Drama went to Murphy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Again, it's going to come down to the SAG thing. I think Giamatti is going to win. I'm going to tell you why. Giamatti this is his first Best Actor nomination. He's been nominated before for supporting Cinderella Man, nominated for Sideways, not nominated for American Splendor, which are two beloved performances. Now, people are going to be looking at these ballots when they start voting. They're going to be like, Oppenheimer pitcher, Oppenheimer director. Hey, I like that Sideways guy.
Yeah, you know, he's great in everything he does. Let's reward him. And that's another thing that the Oscars tends to do is late in somebody's career, they have a tendency to reward someone who's been overlooked, Jack Palance.
Right, exactly.
So that could play a role in this. Like, this guy is due.
You know, like how they blackballed Lord of the Rings until Return of the King. All right, we were holding this off for 2 years. Everything goes to him. Yeah. They're not even in that category. Animation, just give it to him.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'll concede your point that he just might win it because he's due to win it, and nobody would be outraged if he were to win it because it's a fine, fine performance. But
Giamatti.
I don't know. I'm going with Murphy on this one. Supporting actor, Sterling K. Brown, American Fiction. Robert De Niro, again, Killers of the Flower Moon. Robert Downey Jr., Oppenheimer. Man. Ryan Gosling, Barbie. Mark Ruffalo, Poor Things.
I love Sterling K. Brown, but I know the room's going to tell me to go with, because he did a great job, Downey.
Yeah.
When I saw him for the first time on screen with that bald cap, and the black and white scenes, I thought, he's playing against type. He's not the good guy in this movie. This, like we were talking about, the second half of that movie where it gets more political and stuff, he shines. He
starts like turning on Oppenheimer.
And then I texted all my movie nerd friends after I got out of the movie. And I said, RDJ for sure is going to get nominated for supporting, should win.
Yeah.
And I still stand by that.
Yeah. You know what's nice about social media is you can post that stuff and then go back to it. I had something pop up recently where I said, congratulations to Emma Stone for her Oscar win for La La Land. I posted that a couple of months before the Oscars, and it panned out. Yeah. And I feel the same way about RDJ. He's beloved in Hollywood. He's gone through some stuff. This is the time for Hollywood to embrace him and reward him. And I have no doubt in my mind he's going to win it.
And someone correct me on this. I feel like there's like this man sacrificed 10 years, in the Middle East 10 years, he gave it to the popcorn munchers at Marvel. Now he's come back to his acting roots.
Right.
Let's reward him.
But did he not act in those Marvel movies, though? I think he acted his butt off in those movies.
It's a comic book movie. We already know they don't care.
Not recognized by the Oscars, but he made those movies transcend popcorn movies.
Yeah, he did, and I agree with you, but my main thing is he played so well against type.
Right.
He put 100% into that role against type, and not an easy thing to do.
I'm with you, Joe. He's the clear frontrunner. Nobody could top him. I have to say, I am disappointed with an actor I thought got snubbed in this. I just wanted to mention this is Charles Melton for May December, my absolute favorite supporting performance. And he had a lot of early momentum, and it's the movie with Julianne Moore and Natalie Portman. It's on Netflix. It's nominated for Best Original Screenplay.
Is he the younger?
It's about the true, kind of based on a true story about a woman who was 35, played by Julianne Moore at the time. She had an affair with a 13-year-old young boy. She went to jail, and they got back together, and they are still together. And Natalie Portman plays the actress who goes and does like an independent movie about it to research the role of Julianne Moore, and it kind of gets into that whole frenzy and whatnot. But Charles Melton plays the husband who was the 13 and now a 35-year-old boy, and they had kids together, and great performance. But
interesting.
He didn't get nominated, though.
Let's talk about Ryan Gosling for a second. I'm almost embarrassed to say this. I'm almost afraid that people will retaliate against this comment, but when I saw Barbie a week or so after it had come out, like I said, I was probably the only guy in the theater. I walked out thinking Ryan Gosling was awesome in this movie, but I was afraid to say it because
he was good.
Again, the whole patriarchy theme of the movie, I was afraid to say that Ryan Gosling was great. Now that this controversy has happened and he's gotten this nomination, I'm like, well, yeah, that's because he was great in it.
Sure.
I don't think it has anything to do with the patriarchy.
Yeah, he did. No. You could say that if, like, Will Ferrell got nominated instead of him. Then you'd be like, wait, what?
Yeah. Now, is he going to win it? No.
No.
As a matter of fact, I think of the five, he's probably least likely to win it.
Yeah.
He's going to lose to Robert Downey.
You know, Robert just mentioned someone about you talk about actors got left out. I just realized this. How did Leo not get a nomination for
Flower Moon?
Yeah. Flower Moon.
Yeah, that's actually my second favorite performance in that whole category. But he lost a lot of momentum these last few weeks, and he didn't really campaign himself. He was really there campaigning for Lily Gladstone.
And for Scorsese, I think.
I think in a lot of these performances here, like Coleman Domingo, it's just Rustin's that type of campaigning where Netflix just campaigned for Domingo for that particular actor. And Giamatti at the time was like sixth, and then now he is one of the front runners right now. Yeah. But that film just picked up a lot of momentum. And Leo has been nominated a lot before. It's probably one of those things where, like, he's already won it.
But that goes to one. If this had been one of those flex categories, you could have added a sixth person on here.
Oh, like he would have been six. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah. Let's look at supporting actress. Emily Blunt, Oppenheimer, did a phenomenal job. Mm-hmm. Daniel Brooks for The Color Purple. America Ferrera for Barbie. Jodie Foster for Naiad. Divine Joy Randolph for The Holdovers. Again, who do you think the front runner is here? I mean, Emily Blunt was phenomenal. Oppenheimer has a lot of momentum. I've seen negative backlash for The Color Purple, so she may be a victim of that.
Is it tougher for remakes? Like, I know, like, A Star Is Born and The Color Purple. Like, these movies, you know, like, they, you do a remake, and it's like we were talking about this for Greta Gerwig with Little Women.
Mm-hmm.
The thing was, her version didn't really add anything to the previous version, so that's why she got snubbed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Star Is Born got a lot of recognition, and that's been remade like five times.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I don't know. Now, you know, the original Color Purple wasn't as well received as you may think it was. There was, like, a lot of criticism for the original movie. And from what I understand, this is a musical take on it.
Was that Spielberg?
Yes,
I think
Spielberg.
'85.
Yeah. So I think the musical aspect is rubbing people the wrong way. So I just don't know.
I'm going with Randolph.
So America Ferrera, again, people are a little surprised by that. I'm a little surprised by that. Jodie Foster, who's always great.
I reserve the right to change my opinion until after Robert speaks.
I think this is I don't want to say a two-horse race because that doesn't sound right, but a two-actress race. I think it's between Emily Blunt and Divine Joy Randolph. What are your thoughts? Who's going to come away with it? Randolph?
I like Randolph, but I have my pen. I'm going to change this.
Randolph,
true man of my conviction.
I think Randolph's the safe bet here. Fantastic. She won the Globe. She won a lot of critic associations for supporting. She's going to win the SAG. I think she's going to win this. It's a terrific performance too.
When is the SAG, by the way?
Screen Actors Guild.
No. When?
Yeah. Oh, when is?
I'm not that much of a Rube Joe.
What is this SAG you speak of?
So
I'm not sure when.
There's the Producer Guild, there's the Directors Guild. So they do their own nominees, which are most of the time a reflection of what the Oscars are going to pick. It's some of the same people, but the Oscars have far more larger committee. But when you do with actors, it's just actors voting on actors in this. So
when did they announce those?
They announced the nominations. The winners, I think, are a week or two usually before.
Mid to late February then? All right, cool.
Okay. So, I think we're all in agreement there. Let's move on to director.
My favorite.
Hopefully I don't know if I can pronounce some of these names. Justine Triet, am I pronouncing that right?
Yep.
Was it?
Trier.
Yeah. Anatomy of a Fall, Yorgos Lanthimos from Poor Things. I understand he has a track record. I have a friend that's a huge fan of his work.
Yeah, he's got some Lobster. He's got some crazy movies.
Dogtooth.
We have this young upstart. I don't know where he came out of. Christopher Nolan for Oppenheimer. Another young upstart, Martin Scorsese for Killers of the Flower Moon. Jonathan Glazer for The Zone of Interest. Imagine going up against some of these heavyweights, man. That's tough. I think Nolan is probably going to secure it. You said Scorsese already got his for The Departed, right?
Yeah.
So has Nolan, not only has Nolan not won, correct, but he's part of the reason, because of that whole expanded Best Picture thing, that people were outraged that The Dark Knight got a lot of accolades and he did not get nominated for Best Director. Caused some controversy too. So
I forgot about that.
So
I think he's got it.
Yeah. Nolan?
Oh, absolutely. He's the front runner here. It's his year. And this is only his second Best Director nomination. He was nominated for Dunkirk, but he was never.
Oh,
he was nominated for some screenplay nominations before for Memento.
Yeah.
In 2002.
That's so shocking because what's the big movie he did with DiCaprio?
Inception.
Inception.
Yeah.
For a human being to take that concept and depict it on film.
Yes.
The way he did, yeah.
Yep. It's crazy that he wouldn't get recognition for that. Yep. That's an artist painting with on a canvas.
Yep.
So it is pretty shocking. So this might be an opportunity for, again, Hollywood to apologize and bow down and go, please forgive us and give him this award. Not that it's not deserved, but it's time. I think it's time for Nolan to get it. Yep. I don't necessarily need to go into all these other. Is there any other categories that jump out at you that you guys want to touch on?
Cinematography?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We could go with, I think, Oppenheimer.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah, the fact that they use very little CGI in that, a lot of it was practical effects.
And
that's huge.
If you read in how they created that explosion, and they try to make it as powerful and big as possible without actually making an actual nuclear weapon.
Can we get an actual nuke? No, Christopher, we can't do that.
You know, he asked the DOD if he could do it, but no.
I wish I had the audio drop of Doc Brown going, maybe plutonium's available in every corner store, but it's a little hard to get in 1955.
Chris. So. No, for me, it's international feature film because you know exactly what I'm going to cry about. Godzilla minus one. How? Look.
Hey.
You're talking about in the effects category or the cinematography? You wish it was nominated for cinematography?
Me personally, it should have been nominated for Best International Picture, and instead Perfect Days, which is a slice of life movie from Japan, which it's a great performance, but compared to Minus One, I also thought it should have been nominated for cinematography, costume design, production design, and sound.
All right. I want to say something about cinematography. This is sort of a pet peeve of mine. What was the movie with the tiger on the raft? Was that Life of Pi?
The only directed film.
That movie, if I remember correctly, was nominated for cinematography.
Yes.
That movie is like 90% CGI.
Right.
And that is a huge pet peeve of mine.
Agreed.
That if you're allowed to create landscapes using software on a computer, that should not compete against a camera shooting on film or shooting digitally through an eyepiece with somebody looking behind it going,
shooting on 35mm like Nolan did.
And it's like, okay, now the sun is setting and roll, capture this sunset. Where on a computer, you can go place the sun here. That's a huge pet peeve of mine. Yep. I do not think that digitally created landscape should be considered in the same category as some of these other films. Not that I'm saying any of these are, but that's kind of a pet peeve of mine. And I think there should be a separate category. You know, like when Disney does these live action remakes, the expression live action makes me laugh because they are 100% or for the most part 90% digitally created. Right. That's not a live action film. Yeah. So I wanted to get that off my chest with cinematography that I think the films that deserve to be recognized are films that are shot through the lens of a camera because that is so much more challenging than creating something on a PC or a Mac.
I think it's also giant monster bias with Godzilla Minus One.
I was going to get with that was the reason why Godzilla didn't get the internationals because I don't like the rules, but the country can only submit one film.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Japan went with Perfect Days.
Oh.
And again, that's all part of my ire is reserved for the Japanese people. Like, what are you doing?
This is your national mascot.
I always thought the international should follow the best picture, whatever's released here, and the theater should reflect that, and you could open up to any country. So three great Japanese movies, which there were a lot of great Japanese movies last year, The Boy and the Heron was released. Perfect Days is another great movie.
It felt like four short stories all rolled into one.
Right. Monster is another great Japanese movie.
You know? Yeah. I guess you could say that Godzilla is kicking the door open for kaiju movies in the future.
It will.
And it shows that these movies can be taken seriously.
I would be genuinely interested in your opinion when you do get a chance to watch it. If you can watch it when it comes out at home.
It's coming out in black and white. Yes, it's getting a black and white re-release, and I'm very intrigued because I grew up with the original black and white Godzilla. So I might check it out this weekend in theaters when they release it in black and white.
I might see it in black and white as well because I saw it when it first came out, and it did a phenomenal job. I know people are like, well, good for a Godzilla movie. I'm like, no. Good movie.
It's the best Godzilla movie I've ever seen. Wow, yeah. Anything else you guys want to touch on?
The international, I want to say, I think that if you look at the nominees, Zone Adventurous was nominated for Best Film. It's got to win international.
Yeah.
It's kind of like one of those things where Roma in 2018.
Yes.
When was not nominated for Best Picture, but Cuarón won Director, and it clearly won the international. That's right. Parasite, too.
Yeah, yeah. That always, Parasite won Best Picture.
Right?
Yeah.
Best Picture and Best International.
Okay, yeah. That, which is rare, because usually what the Oscars do is they take a foreign language film and give it the consolation prize of Best Foreign Film.
Right.
When in reality, it could very well be Best Picture. And a perfect example for me is Life is Beautiful.
Yeah.
Life is Beautiful. It's one of the greatest movies I've ever seen. It did not win Best Picture. I think it was nominated, but I don't think
Shakespeare in Love, it lost.
Okay, so it lost that year. God, what a year for movies. But yeah, the consolation prize was Best Foreign Film, and so it got its Oscar. But that's kind of what the Oscars do. Like, well, we'll give you the foreign film Oscar, but we're going to give the Best Picture to one of our own, I guess, if you could say that. But that seems to be a trend. But I guess Parasite sort of bucked that trend because it won Best Picture. So, yeah.
Still haven't seen it.
Great movie. You gotta watch it, Andrew.
It was not what I expected. It takes some interesting twists and turns.
You know, the weirdest thing, I see Johnny here for original score for Indiana Jones, Dial of Destiny, but I think it's going to be Oppenheimer.
Yeah. Oppenheimer's
going to win. Yeah. Was that Ludwig Göransson? Who did the score? Or was it
for Oppenheimer?
Shoot.
It's not
you are a walking conundrum. So, you know all these details, but you've never watched like some of the most amazing movies. I can't.
Yeah,
that's part of your appeal, Andrew.
Oh, thank you. I have a little bit of it.
The one that haunts me is L.A. Confidential. I can't believe you haven't seen L.A. Confidential.
Music by Ludwig Göransson, who also didn't he do the theme song for Mandalorian?
Oh, did he?
Swedish guy. He's done tons of stuff.
It's a great score, you know.
Yes.
Anyway, he's done a lot of good stuff. Young guy. He's my age. He was born in 84, so. Wow. Yeah, young.
You got to be questioning all your life decisions, knowing this guy your age is accomplishing so much.
I know.
We only got a few minutes left. We got about 10 minutes left. I always say with a lot of these Oscar nominations, there's a disconnect, and a lot of these movies I haven't seen or just not interested in, or when I do get around to see them, I'm disappointed or flat out hate. No Country for Old Men. But I have to admit, I was shocked when, in 2018, one of my favorite movies, if not my favorite movie of that year, was The Shape of Water. I did not think it had a snowball's chance in hell to win Best Picture that year, which it did. And people were outraged. People were like, you got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
I freaking love that movie. Do you guys have any other titles you want to share where either a movie that you loved and embraced won, or maybe something that you like were shocked at?
One quick thing. Adapted screenplay, Barbie. What are they adapting it from?
The Mattel line. It fits the role because it's based on characters before.
I thought adaptation has to be off like a book.
Right.
Now it's an existing property.
Yeah.
No, God in heaven.
I forced them to do that.
I'm giving that to Oppenheimer then, and I'm going to give Holdovers for original screenplay. But as far as snubs are concerned, I think back to 2001, Michael Gambon winning for Iris when it should have gone to Sir Ian McKellen for Gandalf. I have said my piece.
An indie film that I loved, that one, and I was surprised, but I loved it. I don't know if you've seen it probably, but Birdman with Michael Keaton.
I love that movie. 2015. I loved it.
Have you seen it?
My God, do we have to take a shot? He's seen one of them? 2015, yes, Andrew, I have seen Birdman.
So that, going back, that was the last winner that I actually saw. Was
wow.
Birdman.
That was a surprising winner. I think it was well-deserved.
Love that.
The interesting thing about Birdman is if you liked Birdman, you got to go all the way back to Alfred Hitchcock. He did a movie called Rope. And
it's a lot like that. You're right.
Exactly. So his premise for Rope, now keep in mind they shot on film at the time. So Hitchcock would block and choreograph these scenes and script them so that each scene lasted the exact length of the film that was on the camera, so that the scene would end and the film would go, you know, so each reel was one complete scene. So as they got to the end of the scene and they knew they were running out of film, the camera would back into like somebody's back or go into a dark corner, and then there'd be a reel change and they would start the next scene. So each reel was one long, continuous, unedited sequence with a minor exception toward the end. And Birdman did the exact same thing where they used digital trickery to kind of hide the seams. But if you go back and watch Birdman, the movie looks as if it was shot in one long, continuous, unbroken take.
That's what made me fall in love. Of course, Michael Keaton. Just real quick, didn't you... For the film class, didn't you show a clip of that?
I might have, yeah.
Because I remember, the sets would move.
Yeah, and, so as the camera passed through a doorway, it was too big to pass through the doorway, so they devised these sets on casters that would pull apart so the camera can move forward.
You did show that clip in the class.
It's brilliant, and it's amazing that when you talk about Hitchcock, that movie doesn't come up in those conversations, but it's absolutely brilliant, and Birdman took a page from that.
You know, piggybacking off of that, I'd love, Rob, what do you think about 1917, that continuous shot as a director? Do you sit there and go,
oh, that's another one. Yeah.
Oh, God. Yeah. I mean, do you sit there with the, do you go, okay, this is the day. We got to get this.
Well, that 1917 is another one of those films. I do think it's getting to the point now where it's starting to become an exhausting gimmick where we've seen it so many times, but it's still impressive. 1917 still awed me. I'm like, how do they do that? And it's still well directed. But the one movie that I love that did it kind of briefly before that would be Children of Men, Alfonso Cuarón.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
A lot of films that he did the long take with too.
What's your personal feeling on as a director when you sit there? Would you ever do the long shot?
I love it. I love long takes. Paul Thomas Anderson, he's a big director, favorite director of mine. He does those a lot as well. But if it's motivated, it's not too showy, and it moves the story, I'm all for it.
With a purpose, not just for the gimmick purposes.
Right. It shouldn't be showy or.
Yeah.
Well, when the Steadicam was relatively new, they did that long continuous sequence in Goodfellas where he's trying to impress his date. Show that in classes all the time. Like, check this out.
How long do you think it takes to block that out? Oh. Well, like the prep on that, like, guys, we have to get this. Don't mess this up on like 99 out of 100.
Weeks. And we have to restart over again. Planning, and everyone has to hit their marks and. It's so impressive, and I never did look up to see how many takes it took to get that right, but man, that's so impressive.
Or do you just have to pray you have a good editor so that you, hey, can you take the first 99% of take two and the last and make it look like one scene?
Possible. Yeah, it's tough because it's moving when you're doing when those images move. It's really difficult to spend every little frame of that.
Yeah, jeez.
Yeah. all right. Well, it looks like we're winding down. So we're going to revisit this topic when the winners are announced and we get to talk about all the controversies and things that happened during the telecast. I'm sure.
February 20th at the Oscars? March 20th. March 20th.
March
10th.
Yep.
Sunday.
March 10th. Yep.
All right.
I just looked up the SAG Awards, February 24th.
There we go.
So like you said, that's Robert said, it's usually a decent predictor of how the Academy Awards are going to go. So watch the SAG Awards.
There you go. Fill out your ballot. Yes. All right, Robert, thanks for joining us. You can join us anytime.
Thank you, Robert. Added a lot to our podcast.
Your upcoming projects?
Phantom Moon, and then if you want to watch Bloody Immortal, it's on Amazon Prime and Tubi.
Yep.
Fantastic.
Awesome.
Yep. I watched it, and I can vouch for it. It's a well-made local movie. So, yep.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks, and we're going to end with our little closing theme song.
Come to the movies, watch Charlie Chaplin, and put some sunshine into your day. Forget the hard times, come to the movies, and try to laugh your troubles away.